Well, hello there and welcome. Today is Monday, October 24th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a little over 2 weeks to go before Americans vote for a president.
If we don't work as hard as we can in these next 16 days, all that progress could be out the window.
Another woman accuses Donald Trump of inappropriate behavior. America's favorite pastime, baseball, readies for the World Series.
A lot of Cubs fans have been waiting for this for a long, long time.
Also ahead, how poetry is helping troubled teens. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, with little more than 2 weeks to go before Americans vote for a new president, the candidates are making their closing arguments. Donald Trump campaigning in Naples, Florida, Sunday.
Early voting begins tomorrow, and you can already get your absentee ballot. Get out, get it. Let's start the voting. Numbers are looking phenomenal in Florida. Don't believe the media. But even the media is giving pretty good numbers. They can't help it. But the numbers are even better than what they're saying. So get out. We'll get rid of crooked Hillary once and for all. And that'll be that.
President Obama spent Sunday campaigning in Las Vegas, Nevada for Hillary Clinton.
For all the progress we've made, if we don't work as hard as we can in these next 16 days, all that progress could be out the window. Because competing for the job I currently hold, you've got a guy who proves himself unfit for this office every single day, every single way. And on the other side, you've got somebody who is as qualified as has ever run for the presidency, Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Well, early voting is already underway. About 5 million Americans have already actually voted as Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton make their final case. International Edition's Jim Stevenson talks about it with VOA's Michael Bowman.
Early voting is going on, and there is some data trickling out that would seem to be favorable to Democrats. In certain key districts, in key counties, in key states within the country, the Democratic turnout seems to be quite strong right now. And this gets to an overall point. I think that pollsters, when they try to predict, as this brand new poll from ABC News showing Clinton with a 12-point lead, that is all with the polling institutions predicting who is going to show up, having a group of likely voters who they think will actually go and cast ballots. But this is an election where there's huge disgust across the political spectrum. And we don't know if voter turnout is going to be depressed across the board, if it's going to be more depressed among right-leaning voters, more depressed among left-leaning voters. There are plenty of conservatives who are absolutely disgusted with Donald Trump. But does that mean that they won't vote at all? We don't know. There are plenty of Bernie Sanders voters who are not thrilled with Hillary Clinton. Will they not show up and vote? We just don't know. And I think that this is one election cycle where the actual voter turnout is something of a mystery. And so I'm somewhat suspect of any poll because I just don't know who's actually going to show up. And really, that's the name of the game in terms of winning an election.
It really comes down to the Electoral College, and that's a state-by-state thing. So some states have more electoral votes because they're bigger states. It goes by population. And it tends to be skewed toward the coasts. So if Hillary Clinton is doing really well coast to coast, so to speak, and Donald Trump has the center of the country, it goes towards Clinton's camp at this point.
Indeed. I mean, you look at the map of the United States, and essentially from the northernmost plains, the Dakotas, you can draw a straight line down to Texas. And before you get to Texas, you go through all these states, huge amounts of geography that combined all add up to about 21 electoral votes.
Right. Because
which is just a little bit more than the state of Massachusetts.
Right.
And you could fit 20 Massachusetts into any of these large states that are in the center of the country.
I was reading a few stories over the weekend that where Clinton, now becoming increasingly comfortable with her lead, is trying to affect some of these races in the Senate and the House, because obviously if she's president and both of those chambers are Republican, she's not going to get very far as, you know, trying to push through any sort of agenda. However, if she does have her party in control of at least one of the chambers, then she has a shot of doing some of the things that she has talked about doing on the campaign trail.
This is true. If she had the House, she would love the House. Most people think that the House is out of reach for Democrats, but not so the Senate. Republicans currently have a 4-seat majority in the Senate, but Republicans are defending twice as many seats as Democrats in the Senate. So just numerically, Democrats have so many more opportunities to pick up those 4 seats that they would need. And I say 4 seats, assuming a Clinton presidency in which, if it were split 50-50, presumably Vice President Kaine would be the deciding vote, and therefore the Democrats would have the majority.
All right. That's VOA's Michael Bowman talking to International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Well, meanwhile, another woman has come forward with allegations of sexual misconduct against Donald Trump. Jessica Drake, an adult film star, is the 11th woman to accuse Trump of touching her without permission.
This is not acceptable behavior for anyone, much less a presidential candidate. I understand that I may be called a liar or an opportunist, but I will risk that in order to stand in solidarity with women who share similar accounts that span many, many years.
Well, women will play a key role in picking the next president of the United States. They represent 53% of the electorate. And since women were granted the right to vote in 1920, no presidential candidate has won without their support. But with just over 2 weeks to go, Donald Trump has an uphill battle given the allegations and comments he's made in the past. Joining me to discuss, Valerie Sperling, professor of political science at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. What's your take on the election with a candidate like Donald Trump?
I think in some ways it looks more unprecedented than it is, in the sense that, you know, one of the main things that really stands out about this election is the degree to which there's been so much public discussion of misogyny, you know, that misogyny and Donald Trump's sexist statements in particular have kind of been at the center of the news for quite a while now. And so that seems unconventional, but I think in reality, it's actually quite common for political actors, political candidates, to use gender norms. In other words, to use masculinity and femininity and our understandings of masculinity and femininity to bolster themselves and to try to undermine their opponent. You know, male political candidates will, in kind of more subtle ways, show that they are, you know, manly and tough and strong, and that they have those kinds of qualities that we associate with political leadership, sort of decisiveness, rationality, strength, toughness. And they will try to undermine their opponents by saying that their opponents are weak and incompetent. And sometimes they use even more subtle language. Like if you think back to the primaries and the Republican primaries, there you have Donald Trump talking about Jeb Bush as being low energy.
Mm-hmm.
That is just code, right, for saying not sufficiently masculine to do this job.
So do you think Donald Trump is a misogynist? Do you think he is sexist?
You know, I am of the school, right, that likes to condemn people's behaviors rather than the person themselves, although Donald Trump has pretty well pushed me to the breaking point on this one.
Hmm.
He certainly says a lot of misogynist things, and, you know, from some of the testimony that we've heard from women, it looks like he has also concretely been, you know, abusive to at least a handful of women. But yeah, he certainly talks a good game in terms of sexism and misogyny.
As you mentioned, some of these accusations that have come forward recently, his responses to those accusations were a little bit questionable by some.
Well, I mean, what is he going to say? You know, oh, that's absolutely right. I remember putting my hand up.
But
her,
I mean,
you know?
More specifically, referring to their looks.
Oh, yes. No,
referring
exactly
to
true. That's
talking
right.
about Hillary Clinton, he stood behind her and wasn't impressed.
That's right. That's right. I mean, he has been making statements like that for a long time. time. It goes back, you know, quite a ways. I think that Donald Trump's main MO when it comes to women who publicly criticize him is precisely to insult them on the basis of their looks. And so from, you know, for Hillary Clinton, oh yeah, I stood behind her and, you know, I wasn't impressed. And for Megyn Kelly, you know, he reduced her to her uterus. You know, she had blood coming out of her wherever. And Carly Fiorina, you know, his challenger in the Republican primary, oh, look at that face. Is that a face you would vote for the presidency? And when, you know, journalist Gail Collins criticized Trump as a financially embittered thousandaire, you know, some years ago, he sent her a copy of the column with her picture circled, and he had written the face of a dog, you know, over her face. I mean, he's insulted on the basis of, you know, their looks. Cher, Bette Midler, Angelina Jolie, Rosie O'Donnell, calling them, well, things maybe one doesn't want to repeat, but basically saying that how extremely unattractive they are, you know, all in response to criticism, that's his main method of responding.
It's interesting, though, because you've got the Republican presidential candidate being accused of being a misogynist, accused of being sexist, and he's running against the first female nominee. So is that making a difference?
I think, in a way, what we have is the perfect storm. You know, we have Donald Trump as a candidate who tends to be pretty unfiltered, I think, in what he says. And we know that, you know, sort of sexist comments, just like racist comments, are part of his repertoire. These are things that I think come to him automatically to say. He doesn't filter them. I think putting that together with having Hillary Clinton as the first female nominee for president of a major party in the United States, it's almost as if her status as a presidential candidate acts like a lightning rod.
Is there a different standard for women in politics, particularly this particular woman?
I think on the face of it, it's pretty clear that there is a different standard for women at this level, at least, of political leadership. And I think you can see it so clearly. You know, if you just imagine for a moment, right, that Hillary Clinton had five children, you know, by three different husbands, or that she had an multiple affairs. There's no way, right, that she would have ended up as the nominee. I think there is just a higher standard for how we expect women to behave in general.
And do you think that would be the case if she becomes the president?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, you know, there is that old saying that women have to do, you know, twice as well to be deemed half as good. You know, I'm sure she's going to have to work hard, but that's how she works anyway. You know, Hillary Clinton seems like someone who is uniquely well prepared to do this job and to do it about as well as a person could.
All right. Valerie Sperling, we appreciate it. She's the professor of political science at Clark University in Worcester, Massachusetts. Turning now to what's being talked about on social media, could be that very subject. G. Abby Lee. Hi, G.
Hi, Lori. So the U.S. presidential election continuing to be a hot topic in the news. Of course, we know it's just a couple of weeks away now. Is that also the case online?
Absolutely. It has been a great weekend for both Trump and Clinton. But let's talk about the GOP candidate first, since allegations against him are more recent. Women from all walks of life came forward since a leaked tape in which Donald Trump said demeaning things about a female TV host. Now, to be fair, he denied all those accusations and said he will press charges against those women.
Okay, so what's the latest?
As of now, the number of women who came forward with sexual accusations against him have jumped to 11. So Jessica Drake, who is an adult film performer and director, argued that Trump approached her with an indecent proposal 10 years ago. She also said he kissed her without her consent.
And what's the public's reaction like?
Lori, some people are saying they cannot take Drake seriously because of her profession, but others are saying she still deserves to voice her opinions.
Okay, well, let's turn now to the Democratic side. What's the big news on Hillary Clinton?
It's still surrounding the Clinton Foundation. Some view that she skirted questions about the foundation's misgivings during the final presidential debate. American news magazine The Atlantic tweeted she gave no ground to the allegations at the debate. Now, to that tweet, one of her supporters tweeted, "There's no ground to give because nothing wrong was done." But her critics replied by alleging that she took millions of dollars from the Haiti Relief Fund. Lori, back to you.
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA underscore I-E. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Iran's president criticizes U.S. presidential candidates. Russian jets pummel Aleppo, Syria. A Mars probe crash site has been photographed. And Tom Hanks sees lessons for the election in his new thriller, Inferno. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our internet and our mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues now. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte expressed hope Sunday that fishermen would be able to soon return to the disputed Scarborough Shoal in the South China Sea. It's an area seized by China in 2012 and which the Philippines fought against to the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague. In July, the court rejected China's territorial claims over much of the South China Sea. VOA's Victor Beattie asks Dr. Carl Thayer, professor of emeritus at the University of New South Wales in Australia, what he makes of Mr. Duterte's comments during a recent trip to China, where he pivoted toward China and said he was breaking ties with Washington.
Good boy, bad boy. The good boy is, because of the arbitral award, those two countries are the only ones that must carry it out. So at least it establishes some common ground, and the fact that Duterte is open with China ends a two-year hiatus in relations, and in my estimation, provides China incentives to be more cooperative with the Philippines and downplay militarization and downplay aggressive action by its Coast Guard. And we have to watch and wait and see, because that certainly will set Duterte off. Bad boy. I mean, it's small town mayor becoming president and saying nasty things about the U.S. president, the head of the U.N. Secretary General, offering to pull out, waxes and wane, where his aides have got to scurry all around the place and add explanations. And in my recent trips, I've spoken to many Philippine ambassadors and other officials, and they just say they have to wait it out. We're seeing words and hurtful words and unstatesmanlike words, but we're not yet seeing official action that informs the United States. Assistant Secretary of State Danny Russell is there trying to seek clarification of what he means. He may be playing, some Philippine analysts say he's playing a game. This endears him to China. He can win there. But that's not the kind of ally the United States would want. It wants an ally that is willing to carry its own share. And that's why Duterte is off the mark when he says we get hand-me-down weapons and no rockets on the South Korean planes we built because of the U.S. The question has to be, will you fund your own modernization, or are you wanting to depend on the United States to do your own defense? And that's not what allies are for. Allies have to bring something to the table.
The Obama administration, of course, on its way out the door. What happens to the rebalance to Asia?
Well, one sense is, so on the military side, the rebalance could be dented by Duterte if he undermines the enhanced defense cooperational agreement that allows for the rotation of American forces. But the U.S. is still capable of maintaining a naval presence in the area and an air presence, but not with the ease it would have had in the Philippines. But the other leg, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, looks to be well and truly kicked out because of the caustic American reaction to globalization and the fact that two presidential candidates are against it. That leaves 11 countries high and dry in the region that very much wanted the TPP with the U.S. So the rebalance, in my estimation, has a shelf life until around January 17th, and the new president will call it by another name.
That's Dr. Carl Thayer speaking with VOA's Victor Beattie. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Join us for VOA's coverage of the most important U.S. political event of the year. Americans will decide who their next president will be. We'll have all the context, commentary, and analysis with our coverage of the U.S. presidential election. Right here on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beattie.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA. a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Chicago Cubs ended one of Major League Baseball's longest championship droughts for a U.S. professional sports team. Their defeat of the Los Angeles Dodgers in Game 6 of the 2016 National League Championship Series brings the pennant back to Chicago for the first time since 1945, and it sets the Cubs against the Cleveland Indians in the World Series beginning on Tuesday. Joining me to talk more about this, one of America's favorite pastimes, Washington-based sports reporter Jay Brooks. Jay, how big of a deal is the game in this country? And of course, how big of a deal is the Cubs making it to the series?
It's a huge deal. You know, the World Series officially since 1903, where the Boston Pilgrims defeated Pittsburgh. There's always been this great optimism come every spring that your team's going to be there in the fall for the World Series. And over the years, during the war years in the 40s and such, people listened to baseball games and it was part of their lives and kind of kept the country together. And as time has gone on, baseball's lived because it's the sport of the summer. You can take your kids there. It's not too hard a game to follow. And with the Cubs not winning this World Series since 1908, and the Cleveland Indians not winning a World Series since 1948, this is going to be a real exciting seven-game series.
Well, who are the two teams playing again?
They haven't won it since 1908.
Okay.
And they're playing the Cleveland Indians, and they haven't won it since 1948. But the city of Cleveland, before the Cleveland Cavaliers, the basketball team, won a championship, they hadn't won anything since 1964.
Mm-hmm.
So for two teams to be a second championship in 1 year after nothing since 1964 is a big thing.
Right.
But also, the game one of the World Series is in Cleveland, and right across the street, the Cavaliers open their season and will get their championship ring. Then the Cubs, of course, not winning it for so long, and it's a huge story.
Have you been able to talk to any Chicago fans that are and gauge how they're feeling about actually having their team finally get into the World Series?
A lot of them are stoked. Being in D.C., people are from everywhere. Fans are from all over the country for the Cubs, the Indians, any other team. So a lot of Cubs fans who've been waiting for this for a long, long time. They're stoked. They want to get it done. They'll get a chance to host a couple of games at Wrigley Field. I think the series will go six games, three in each city. I think the Cubs should pull this out. It just seems like this tide has kind of turned for the Cubs, and I think that they're going to end up being a chance to break the curse and win the championship.
Well, we will see. Thanks so much, Washington-based reporter Jay Brooks. Well, there are about 80,000 people living in the Za'atari refugee camp in Jordan. For 1 month, that number included documentary filmmaker Chris Temple and fellow producer Zach Ingrassi, setting up tent in the middle of the camp. The Americans meant to experience, along with the Syrian refugees there, how it feels to live that way. Their goal was to communicate their day-to-day interactions with the rest of the world. The result, a documentary called Salam Neighbor. VOA's Penelope Pulu has the story.
In District 5, yeah, it's going to be your temporary home.
This was the first time that Chris Temple and his co-producer were visiting the Middle East.
So when we arrived in that camp, we were really nervous until the second we start setting up our tent, all these refugee families started pouring out of the tents next to us.
Chris Temple told VOA he made this film to dispel this prejudice.
The population that's bearing the biggest burden and fear around terrorist attacks, you know, our refugee populations, our Arab populations and Muslim populations in this region. This isn't, you know, a Muslim versus Christian attack. And imagine being a family inside of Syria right now, where you're stuck between Assad and a group like ISIS.
Salam Neighbor features a number of Syrians, mostly from middle-class families, who fled their country. One of them is 11-year-old Rauf, who suffers from PTSD from bombings near his house. Despite Za'atari's seeming safety, 11 kilometers from the war zone, Bombings still rock the camp.
Well, what did Raouf do wrong? You know, he's a young 11-year-old boy, and in many ways, this refugee crisis, especially the Syrian refugee crisis, is one of women and children. You know, 75% are women and children of the 4.8 million refugees.
Chris Temple hopes his documentary will help open hearts and minds about the millions of Syrian refugees stranded in countries such as Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, and Greece.
I think that one of the biggest myths about refugees is that they're assumed to be burdens. You have doctors, you have lawyers. Ghassoun, one of the people in our film, was a nurse back in Syria. So they have so much they could productively contribute to their whatever new country they're going to.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Well, that does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. You can also like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
About 1 billion people, or every seventh person, suffers from at least one neglected tropical disease. Neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs, are chronic disabling illnesses that thrive in areas with poor sanitation, lack of clean drinking water, and scant access to medication. NTDs have blinded, disabled, disfigured, and killed their victims for centuries, devastating individuals and entire communities. They affect the ability of children to thrive and to learn, and of adults to work, thus perpetuating the cycle of poverty. Nonetheless, most of these diseases are frequently preventable or treatable, often with low-cost medications. So 10 years ago, working through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the United States government launched a public-private partnership to treat those who suffer from NTDs and to help prevent contamination and spread of the parasites that cause them through improved sanitation, preventive treatments, and mass drug distribution campaigns. Working in partnership with the United Kingdom's Department for International Development, the Conrad Hilton Foundation, the Queen Elizabeth Diamond Jubilee Trust, and many more, USAID has been instrumental in the delivery of more than 1.6 billion treatments to prevent and treat seven of the most common NTDs. Some 743 million people across 25 countries directly benefited from these treatments. Much of the medication was donated by pharmaceutical companies, which have given over $11 billion worth of drugs free of charge to the countries where USAID supports mass treatment campaigns. Moving forward, over the next 5 years, USAID and its partners plan to provide 1.3 billion treatments, leverage $6 billion in donated drugs, and prevent more than 585 million cases of NTDs. The partners hope to eliminate trachoma, the world's leading cause of preventable blindness. Lymphatic filariasis, a painful and disfiguring parasitic infection transmitted by mosquitoes. And to break the transmission of diseases like schistosomiasis by improving sanitation. Working together with our partners over the past 10 years, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith, we have figured out an approach that works, and freed over 100 million people from these parasitic worms and bacterial infections that have held communities back for too long. Now is the time to double down and reach scale.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4.